Sounds like a lot of...
Hoopla!
Sounds like a lot
Hoopla!
Of...
Hoopla!
Sounds like a...
Hoopla!
Hey everybody, welcome back to another episode of Aussie Hoopla, the best damn Australian basketball podcast that's on the net. To all the Hoopla heads who've done the smart thing and subscribed to Aussie Hoopla on iTunes so they don't miss an episode, we thank you. And in return for that, I guess, today we've got a very special guest on the show. Now, he didn't win an NBL title, and he never played in the Olympics, and he never flirted with the NBA, but he was one of my favourite players to watch simply because he had swagger. Swagger that not many players had back then, and there's certainly nobody in the NBL today that comes close. Now, basketball seems to be used to guys who don headbands, wear numerous tattoos across their body, they've got bleached or even pink-coloured mohawks, but before, you know, guys like the Denver Nuggets, Chris Anderson got his first tattoo, before Corey Homicide Williams had a mohawk, and even before Dennis Rodman had posed nude with orange-coloured hair, Simon Curl had done all of that. No less in mild-mannered cities like Geelong and Townsville, where the country folk there may not have been as receptive. But that's why I always like Simon Curl. Combine that with the fact that he always spoke his mind. So I look forward to this very much, everybody. I'd like to welcome to the show Simon Curl.
No, it's a pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
I mean, it's you had a 18-year, 381-game career, which saw you play for, you know, a whole host of teams: Brisbane, Townsville, the Geelong clubs, Brisbane Bullets. I'm just wondering, like, when you think back on, you know, the rather extensive career you've sort of had, do you think of yourself like a supercat or a bullet, or do you just sort of look back and every sort of club was its own experience, or how do you look at your own, you know, career now that you've been out of the game for, you know, a few years now?
Yeah, no, it's a good question. I never really think of myself as a super cat. It was just, I think what you said was just really good experiences at, you know, different experiences at different areas, and it was and I think just different times, you know, along your life's journey. You know, when I was at Southern Melbourne and Geelong, I was, you know, in my younger years, and I think your take on things were a little bit differently when you're younger. But I think probably the most fun as far as playing goes, Townsville was good just for the fact that you played in front of packed out crowds every game. You know, the crowds were phenomenal. But I really enjoyed playing with the Southern Melbourne Saints. You know, we had a pretty ragtag group there, but I think we achieved more than most teams thought we would at that time.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. I like the one thing that you still see on the internet these days whenever someone mentions the Southern Melbourne Saints, and that's always about, you know, how, you know, the team sort of did more than what anyone expected them to do. You entered the league with Brisbane back in 1988. You know, obviously your father, Brian Curl, was, you know, a respected and very successful coach in the league. What sort of, you know, I mean, Andrew Gaze obviously is another person from a big basketball family that went on to play with his dad, but, I mean, there's also been, you know, some not really great examples of father-son relationships in the NBL, whether it be Mark Wright and Marcus Wright at Victoria there, and, I mean, you had Stephen Black and Alan Black, which had its ups and downs. What was it sort of drew you to playing under your dad?
I think when I was 18, you know, it was, I had the choice to go to the Institute, or I could have trained and played with, you know, a team that, you know, that won the NBL the year before. And I thought for me, going to college in America would be better playing and practicing against professionals every day, which it was. And then when I came back, you know, the decision for me was I wanted to make my own mark before I went back and played with my father. And I think that's probably one advice I'd give anybody is, you know, when you go out and get your own identity and prove to everybody and yourself that you can play and it's not on the back of your father's name, then it just gives you feel a lot better about that. and I was always glad that I did that. So every other time, the two times I went back to Brisbane, I'd had good careers in other areas and was already established. But at the same time, I found it difficult in the fact that I didn't think that I could play my natural game under him. I was always thinking, oh, what if I do this? You know, and so I wasn't really free flowing under him. And that for me, you know, I found that a little bit difficult.
What about Western Nebraska? Obviously, yeah, like you said, be almost unheard of these days. Someone, you know, a young Australian basketball player choosing, usually they go to the AIS and then progress through there and head to the college. But what was it about the AIS that you thought didn't suit either your game or the path you wanted to take with your basketball?
I'd always wanted to play college in America. You know, and I guess it's not for everybody, but you know, now, you know, the Australian kids now are just, you know, there's such an abundance of good players who do a really good job over in college that it's such a good experience. You get an education, you get to play, you get to live in that college life, you get to play in front of, you know, if you're at a big school, you get to play in front of some pretty amazing crowds. And you can't really get that playing at the AIS, but in saying that, you get coached really well at the AIS. The coaches that they've had there are amazing. You know, Ian Stack is there right now, and you know, fundamentally, he will develop. If you have the skills and you want to work hard, he will get you to the best that you can. And then Marty Clark before him. So they've always had really, really good coaches there. But it's kind of funny. I played at, you know, I'd signed with the University of Nebraska, but they said to me that I had to redshirt. Now, when you're a 17-year-old kid being told you have to redshirt, and you say, what is that? And they say, well, you can only practice, you can't play, and you have to go to school. That's not something that sits well with a 17-year-old. I was like, what? Practice? I can't play. And I said, I didn't really want to do that because I didn't understand the whole basis of redshirting. So, you know, if I look back now, I probably would have redshirted. But, you know, they sent me to a very good junior college. Now, our junior college back then, you could have 15 scholarships. Now, out of the 15 scholarships, 14 of the kids on them had Division I schools to go to after junior college. So, you know, it was pretty good competition. And we had two white guys and the rest were inner city kids. So they were pretty hardcore. It was definitely an interesting time while I was there. You know, kids got put in jail, sent to, put in hospital. It was crazy, but it was fun. You know, I'd always had that dream of playing college basketball. And, you know, from a very early age, you know, that's all I had that was on my mind was I'm going to go play college basketball in America. So, that's why I chose. It's not for everybody, I guess, but, you know, I loved it. The experience was great.
So the beginnings of your career, you start playing under your dad, four-time championship coach, Brian Curl. Down at Brisbane, and I mean the legends on this team is what a great team it was. Obviously, it won the championship the year before in 1987, but you know, names like Hall of Famer Danny Morseau, Leroy Loggins, of course, John Dorge, Ron Radcliffe, Larry Senstock, Emery Atkinson, even Robert Sibley was no slouch. But there was also a slew of guards. Like I said, there was Shane Hill, Leroy Loggins, Ron Radcliffe, Darren Perry was also there. So no doubt it would have been tough your first season. I know you only played six games. So tell us what it was like. Obviously, it would have been, you know, exciting playing under your father. You know, what a special experience that would be. But must have been frustrating, no doubt. Then, you know, off to college and then you're back in the NBL in 1990 in Melbourne this time with Westside Melbourne. Tell us how that chain of events happened.
For me, it was good. You know, they just won the championship the year before. So I was playing with some, you know, I was only 18, so I didn't really expect to play. I just went and trained every day and just knew I was getting ready for college. And then after, my 2 years in college, I just decided that I'd had enough of practicing and playing and studying and not getting paid for it. And then, that's when I reached out to a friend of mine, Ron Bongetti, who was in Melbourne. And I said, mate, can you try and see if there's any spots for me in any of the teams? It was pretty late. I think it was February 1990 when I came back. And the Southern Melbourne Saints, who, you know, my father, they were coached as St. Kilda Saints way, way back in the, early 80s. Yep. They said, listen, we don't have any contracted spots, but you can come and train with us. And what I did was I went there and I looked at the guys on the team and there was one guy who had my spot and it was my duty over the next 3 months to make his life a living hell, and I wanted that spot. And the day before our first game, I think it was the Perth Wildcats, Dean Templeton gave me a call because he was our coach, and he said, "You're in," and that's how it all started. You know, my first year was at I think we were called Westside Melbourne Saints then, and then they changed their name to the Southern Melbourne Saints the year after.
Going back to the Brisbane days, what about when they fired Brian Curl and you at the same time? That I know that back then there was some people thought it was a bit of an unprofessional move, since that you had, you know, pretty good season that year. I think you had around 10 points and 5 rebounds. There wasn't really too many reasons for them to fire you. What were your thoughts on that?
Yeah, it was a pretty disappointing time. You know, that was, you know, that 1991 is when I had a decent season with the Saints, and we did pretty well. And, you know, Brisbane offered me a 2-year deal. And, you know, it was a good deal. It's kind of a little bit hard to say no to. And, you know, the team we had that year, we had Adrian Branch, who I think averaged 28 points a game. Leroy Loggins, who might have averaged 25 a game. Shane Heal, who averaged 25 a game. Andre Moore averaged 22 a game.
And it was a beast as well.
It was a beast. And really, none of them at that stage really enjoyed playing defense that much. So, you know, I kind of thought 10 points, five assists and 5 rebounds was, you know, not bad for a fifth wheel to come on that team and just, you know, play their role. So I still remember the day it happened. I was doing a clinic in Mount Isa, Queensland with Shane Heal. And then I called my dad's secretary and said, "Listen, we need a hire car. Can you help us out?" She goes, "I just want you to know that they've just announced that you've been released." And I said, "Well, I've got another year on my contract." She said, no, they're going to do whatever they can to get you out of it, which they did, which was disappointing. And then I actually remember I'd heard a rumor maybe a week before, and Bruce Palmer was the coach at the time. He'd just been appointed. And I remember I went in and sat down with Bruce and I said, "Oh mate, I'm hearing that you want to get rid of me and I just want to know where I stand." He said, No. "If you're prepared just to work hard and do what you're told, you'll be fine." And I said, "Yeah, that's cool." I said, "You know, I understand it's a profession." And I said, "I feel bad for my dad, but you know, I came to play for the Brisbane Bullets, not play for him." And he said, "No, you'll be fine." And I said, "Well, just make sure you let me know because I'm about to build a house." And he said, No, you'll be fine." And then, you know, a week later, they did what they did. And I think it wasn't just that, it was some of the things that they did afterwards. You know, they wouldn't release me from a contract. You know, they said some pretty nasty things that weren't true. And it gives you a...
What sort of things were said?
They said I had a hubcap missing from the car, and they said that there was $8,000 damage to the car, which there wasn't. There was only a hubcap missing. You know, there's a bunch of other things, and it was just disappointing. You know, and so they wouldn't release me from a contract to even go and play any kind of... So they didn't want me, but they wouldn't let me play with anybody. They just made things extremely difficult. But, you know, the fact that back then the NBL didn't... You know, no one really, I didn't think, did much for the players. They didn't really care for the players. And as a young kid, it fueled the anger that I had in there even more. And we'd probably, you know, I think when I played with a little bit too much hatred. Which fueled my anger to play, but I think it could have been channeled in a more positive way, but that's how I was when I was a bit younger, and just glad that things have changed a lot since then.
Yeah, well, I guess, you know, part of that no doubt can be seen the way you played back in the day. I mean, you know, you were doing a lot of things that not many people, especially in Australia, were doing at that time. I mean, the different coloured haircuts and, you know, the long hair, the short hair, the tattoos, the trash talking. Staying on that for a minute. I mean, what about trash talking? I mean, do you have any, you know, interesting stories from your days as a player? Who are your thoughts on maybe who was the best trash talker back in the day?
I think that was a good trash. I mean, Al Green was pretty good.
But then again, he dropped 71 on you though, so he could talk all he wanted, couldn't he?
I don't think he dropped 71 on me. I don't think he dropped 71 on
me. No, not on you, but yeah,
in the league.
No, but you know, he was pretty good. It was just, I think more than anything, it was more battles. I remember, I'm not sure if you remember a guy called Doug Overton. He played for the Illawarra Hawks, and then he went on to play in the NBA for about 8-9 years, I think.
Yeah, even longer. I think it was about 13 seasons.
And I remember playing Doug one time, and it was in Brisbane, and I tried every trick in the book to put him off his game, roughed him up, trash talk, and he was just so good. He just, I can't remember what he dropped on. It seemed like 44, 45, but you just knew when you walked off the court, you just knew you got your butt kicked, and I got my butt kicked that game. So that was a game, even though it was 1992, I still remember it quite vividly because he just dismantled me. There was nothing I could really do.
Well, we spoke to Rob Rose earlier, and I was talking to him about these types. You bring up Doug Overton, these types of players, the sort of players that come into the NBL, and I sort of use the term one and done. It's sort of what they say in college, how they come and play 1 year and then go. So I was saying to Rob about the imports, like in terms of sort of players that are sort of one and done, like might have played one or two seasons, who are, you know, some of the best players that you've seen. Would Doug Overton be up there for you?
Yeah, definitely for me in that position. You know, Doug was amazing. Bobby Locke was tough too. I mean, I can't remember how long he stayed around for, but he was very tough. But one of the players I think just goes, kind of snuck under the radar a little bit, was Ray Oz. I played with Ray in Geelong and in Townsville, and he was just, he was incredible. You know, he was just an incredible, incredible athlete. Well, probably one of the best rebounders I've seen, shot blockers, and just just very good to play with. You know, he played in the NBA a couple of years, but he was one of those guys I just couldn't understand how he didn't have a more solid NBA career, you know, because he was just...
Physically, he was a beast. But like you said, he only lasted like one or two seasons. I think he played with the Warriors and then might have bounced around with someone else briefly, but yeah.
Yeah, he went to New Jersey, I think, for a year. It's just amazing when you see some of the players, you know, playing in the NBA, and you see someone like Ray, and some of those guys were making, you know, 8-9 million. It was just like, oh, how's this? It's just funny how it works, you know. But great guy, you know. He was good. You know, Paul Maley, when he first came out, I played with Paul his first year in 1990. You know, he was incredible. He was just 6'8". You know, could shoot, could jump. You know, he had a great, you know, great all round game. You know, you know, since I've finished basketball, I honestly haven't really followed it at all. You know, it's been 8 years, so I don't really know too many of the players who have come in and do what. But you know, you speak to a lot of people, and they say that the quality of the imports just isn't the same anymore. And I guess it's because, you know, money's probably a bit rough these days.
I guess money's sort of a part involved. I mean, you also got to not discount the development of the Australian players and that sort of stuff. Like, I mean, back in the late 80s, early 90s, that you're sort of talking about now where the imports are really coming in. Like, you know, we had Doug Overton, Adrian Branch you brought up, and, you know, Andre Moore. All these guys had NBA experience and came out here and just destroyed opponents left, right and centre. But at the same time, Australia as a nation was only, you know, finishing in sort of 12th or 16th come Olympic Games and that sort of stuff back then. So when you look at now, we're sort of a regularly, sort of in the men at least, we're regularly rated between, you know, in the top 10 or the top, you know, I guess you've got to say that the competition's developed, you know, somewhat.
Yeah, but in 96, Australia finished 4th in the Olympics, didn't they? 2000, yeah, finished 4th in the Olympics. Last Olympics, what did they finish? 8th?
Yeah, it was 4th in 96 and 2000, though, so, but yeah.
You know, and, I mean, you look at the thing is now with the good Aussies, I mean, the really good, I mean, there's good Aussies, but they're all, most of them are overseas now, you know?
Yeah.
So you don't have them playing in the NBL. You know, you've got guys like Matty Nilsson and Dave Anderson and Joe Ingles, you know, doing, you know, have done really good things overseas, and you've got Bogut. I mean, it's, you know, back then you had Andrew Gaze, who was at his peak, and you had Shane Heal and Vlahos. Brad, I mean, there was the Aussies playing in the NBL and the Americans were pretty good when you think back now. They were world class. You know, Shane was world class, Andrew's world class. All those guys that, you know, all had stints or had a crack at the NBA at some stage. You know, so
Back then, I guess, like you look at the starters and, you know, bar maybe Luke Longley, the starters were playing in Australia, whereas now on the Olympic team, you've really got to get down to your 7th or 8th guy before you even find someone who's playing in Australia.
Yeah, definitely. Well, it's just there's too much money overseas, you know, and you get taxed so highly over here when you play. If you can go overseas and you can get some euros and, you know, you can get, you know, tax-free money, things like that, it's just always, well, not tax-free, but, you know, just a better deal over there. It's always Well, it's going to be more beneficial to play overseas than it is here, unfortunately.
Yeah, I just had a quick look on the stats. I think Doug Oven had 36, 7 rebounds and 8 assists against you. So it wasn't so bad. It could have been worse. The night before, he had 38, 10 and 10 against the Cannons. So
yeah.
you got off a bit lightly, really.
Mate, he was on the second game, though. That's even better, you know. But he was just so good. I just knew that when I walked off that court, I'd gotten flogged. But he was well classed. He was very good. But we had some really good players come out, you know. I was pretty fortunate. It was good playing. I used to love playing against Willie Farley, and he was a good guy. We always went pretty hard. But at the end of the day, he was always, you know, he was really good after the games. And I always got a little bit frightened when I was isolated on the 45 with him. That was always a scary feeling.
You brought up Europe and that sort of stuff. We're just talking about that. Obviously, you played one season in Italy,
yep.
Club Messina, in yep. 2001.
Yep.
What? How did that sort of develop, and how did you end up there?
It was after during the 2001 season when I was in Brisbane, and I think it was one game to go at the end of our season, and I had an American agent contact me and asked if I'd want to go and play. You know, the end of the Italian season. I said, yeah, that'd be great. For me, it had been something that I'd always dreamed of, playing in Europe. And, so I went over there and I was actually the guy who was my teammate was Scooter Barry, who I actually knew, when he was playing for the Magic. I got to know Scooter pretty well. So he was playing.
I was going to say the son of the legend, Rick Barry.
Son of Rick Barry. So it was good that Scooter was there. He was playing as a local. He had a German passport. But my time in Italy was the basketball wise was the most enjoyable, fantastic journey ever. You know, I loved the town. I loved the whole entire culture. I liked playing as an import. That was good. And you know, over there they don't really care too much. They just care that if you can play basketball and get the job done, then they're pretty happy. You know, if you don't get the job done, they'll hand you a plane ticket and send you straight home. But I'd gone over there just to keep them out of, they were last, and they just, the teams that finish in the top and in the bottom two get relegated, and they didn't want to get relegated. And, we were fortunate enough to make the finals. You know, we won, I think, 4 out of our 5 games and got to the finals, which was good. And, unfortunately, we only won one game in the finals out of the best of 5, but, I kept a diary. I'd never keep a diary ever. And I kept a diary because I just wanted to remember the experience. I remember the day before our first playoff game, I was eating at a, Chinese restaurant with Scooter Barry. And then I think it was 2 o'clock in the morning. I started diarrhea and vomiting for the next 10 hours, 12 hours and lost 7 kilos in 2 days. And, I couldn't answer my phone because I was on the bathroom floor for the whole time. And then the team doctor, the team owner and the team general manager came into my house and they just saw me on the floor. They picked me up, put me in the shower and then put a intravenous drip in my arm. And I sat there for a few hours and then they got my shoes, drove me to the game and then they put me in the locker room. Everybody was warming up. I just had a drip in my arm. And then I sat there for an hour. They put my shoes on and then they walked in. They said, Simon, you're ready to play. I said, I can't play. They said, yes, you'll be okay. So I didn't warm up. They just put me on the court. And I remember chasing the ball down the court and fell over. I couldn't walk. So they subbed me off, left me there for the whole entire game. So I played the first 10 seconds and then sat me on the bench with a drip in my arm for the whole game. And then we were down by 2. With 3 seconds to go and we had the ball out of bounds, they put me back in and they called for me to take the last shot of the game. And I just said, Coach, you're crazy. So all I was praying that the ball would actually hit the side of the backboard because, you know, I just could barely see, let alone shoot. Fortunately enough, it hit the ring. It didn't go in. But it was a crazy time, what you experience over there, but it was the most fun and most, it's something I'll never forget. I loved it. It was fantastic.
2001 too was probably your best year in the NBL. You had like 25 points a game, 4 rebounds, 3 assists. It was also that sort of time where a lot of people thought that you might have been snubbed a little bit by the Boomers team. Do you feel that you should have been a boomer? Or do you think, you know, I know there was one tour you missed out on, you were sort of Aaron Trahair and John really got the nod instead of you. But is that something that you sort of regret or think that, you know, you sort of got the short end of the stick with?
I think all I really wanted was a chance to train, go to an Australian camp. You know, I didn't think it's not saying I deserve to play for Australia, but I definitely think that I deserve to have a chance to train against the best players in the league. And not given that opportunity was really disappointing. You know, Aaron was a good player, but he was, I don't think that he worked as hard as I don't think there's a lot of things I don't think he could do that I could do. And there was, you know, there's other players as well. So to not actually be able to have the chance to go into a camp for a week and play against these guys to see, you know, to say, okay, well, let's see what he can do. And not having that opportunity was disappointing. And it's, you know, I could never understand that. I could never understand how some of the players who got a chance to go and train and actually go on tours, but, you know, I never actually got a chance to go and practice with practice with the best players in Australia. And that's all you want. I'm not saying that I deserve to be in the team, but I definitely deserved a shot to practice against those guys. And that's just a shame. That's one of the things. I mean, you always want to represent your country, and it just would have been really good to go there and be coached by, you know, the Australian coaches, and you just learn so much more when you're in that company. You know, they're the best players in Australia, and you just get to see what other guys are doing, and you might be able to pick up, I might have picked up some things from, you know, John Riley and Brett Maher, and seen things that they did that could have been really beneficial for my game. You know, and I look back now, and it's a shame I didn't get that opportunity, because Brett was amazing. He had such an incredible career. You know, going to a camp and practicing against him and playing with him, I just would have become a better player. And the same with, you know, John Riley and Shane and all these other guys, just having that opportunity would have been, it would have been fantastic.
Like I said, sort of that was sort of Brett Maher's chance to really shine with the Boomers team. It was just after the big five, I guess you could say. Like Shane Heal did eventually return, but Shane Heal, Vlahov, Gaze, Brakey, Longley, they'd all retired from the team. So there certainly was the chance for some new blood to come through the system. Do you think that, you know, something to do with your attitude, the way you didn't get picked up? Or do you think it was just you being on a team that wasn't playoff bound at that time and, you know, sort of putting up good numbers on a bad team? What would you sort of, if you had to guess, what do you think that the reasoning behind that would have been?
Oh, definitely my attitude. You know, I think I was extremely outspoken. You know, probably too outspoken. If I could change change the way, there'd be a lot of things I'd do differently. But that's how I was when I came through. I played with a lot of anger, and it was just, you know, it was channeled, I think, in a negative way. I could have done it a lot better. And going, you know, being in on a bad team, you know, it's hard to want to average, even though you average 25, it wasn't fulfilling because we smashed all the time. But what can you do? All you can do is try your best on a bad team. Now, you can average 25 on a bad team. And if I had to average 10 on a bad team, then nobody would even, you know, they'd say I was only averaging 10 points on the bad team, you know. I would have loved to have averaged 12 points on a team that was in the top four. That would have been great. But unfortunately, the team that was put together by Richard Orlick at that time was not a very good team. And it was very, very poorly coached and poorly run. And, you know, you just had to try and do your best, with what was there. But, you know, out of that, I got to become very good friends with Wade Halliwell, and he remained one of my closest friends. So even though it was, not a good year productive wise basketball, you know, we got a really positive, good friendship out of it with Wade, which is good.
Well, I know, like, one thing that you've always said through your playing career when people have brought up your attitude or, you know, things like that, the perceived negatives of your game, you've always sort of fallen back and said, well, you know, if you've got a problem with any of that, talk to my coaches. You know, you did have some sort of, yeah, like you said, you were on some pretty poorly coached teams, but you were on some pretty, you know, you did play under some pretty good coaches as well. What are some of the, you know, who do you think were some of the best coaches that you've played under?
Even though I didn't really play much with the Magic, under Brian Gorgian, Gorge was fantastic. You know, I learned a lot. He helped me a lot. You know, he kind of helped me get back from after Brisbane doing what they're doing, helped me become, a better rounded player, and that's when I went to Geelong. You know, so that was good. Stacks, you know, I enjoyed playing for Ian Stacker a lot, even though we had a bit of a falling out in Townsville. But, you know, I learned a lot from him. He's a very, very good coach. And it's good that he's coaching the AIS. You know, he's got a lot to offer. So if he wasn't coaching somewhere where he could actually help younger players be productive or professional players be productive, it would be a shame. And I enjoyed playing for Mark Bragg. You know, Braggy was good. You know, he was all the things that he was trying to tell me to help me become a better player. I look back now and I wish I had have taken, you know, note. You know, he's the first person who really tried to channel my anger when I was on the court and, you know, all that. He was trying to channel it in a really positive way. Would give me books, but at that time, you know, I think I was 25, 26. You know, I didn't really listen, but I look back now and I think it cost me a lot not listening to it. You know, so I think Gorge and Stacks were great. Joey Wright was awesome. It was just a shame that I couldn't really, when Joey came to Brisbane, I was injured. You know, for 3 years I was injured. That was very frustrating. My final 3 years of three surgeries. His philosophy was good. His systems were good. And we played a freestyle up and down game. Which was perfect for me. But, you know, when you're playing at about 65% and in agonizing pain the majority of the time, it's hard because I used to love doing extra work training. You know, I used to love doing extra work, but, you know, when you're in that kind of pain, you just can't because your body can't handle it anymore. I had some great coaches, some really good coaches. I was pretty lucky. Just, you know, unfortunately, I definitely think the way my attitude was, it probably held me back a little bit. And, it's one of the things I look back now and I wish I had been smart enough to notice earlier on and just change the way I thought and the way I played with a lot of things.
Yeah, well, you sort of brought up your last season there, 2005 with Brisbane. Like, it was a pretty amazing, you know, just the fact, I remember Joey Wright sort of saying that your comeback, to the elite level was nothing short of amazing. You know, like you said, you took basically 3 years, to recover from the back injury. And most players would have given up, really, and it just goes to show the sort of strength of character that you had on the basketball court as a player. But I think a lot of sort of people, yeah, probably didn't realise that, and they just sort of see, you know, Simon Curl, the braggadocious, you know, long-range assassin, and he was still averaging 12 points a game, you know, 3 rebounds, 2 assists. There's probably a lot of people that thought you could have kept going, and I mean, when you look at it, there's a chance that you probably could have come away with the title if you had been able to hang in there another 1 or 2 seasons. Is that something you think about, or?
No, I think, yeah, a little bit, but you know what, you can keep dragging it out and dragging it out. It had been 18 years. You know, the one thing that I wanted was, I just knew that I could still play. And you know, the average 12 on a team that finished in the, you know, finished third or fourth that year, lost to the Adventure Winners, the Kings. I think the Kings won it that year.
Yeah, yep.
And it's always hard. I think if I had to come back the following year, I would have had a better year because it would have been another year for my body to heal. But, you know, it just didn't work out that way. But, you know, it gave me probably 18 months to 24 months on track of getting ahead in other things in my life.
You know, obviously you've sort of brought up, you know, your long-time, well-publicised friendship with Shane Heal. And, you know, we're sort of talking about, you know, so Townsville's probably one of the better stops on your basketball journey. I read that Shane Heal convinced you to sign with the Suns. That was probably a strange time in your career where you'd been playing for Geelong, and the team just decided to cull, say, the bottom three teams. That was when Geelong, Gold Coast, and the Hobart Devils dropped out. Take us back to that time. How was that? What did that sort of do to you as a player when, you know, you're on a team that's suddenly extinct?
The worst thing was that the thing that disappointed me with that was the NBL stance on that. Now, you know, I can only speak for my owner, and his name was Richard Austin, and I'd been really good friends with Richard the whole 3 years I was in Geelong. Now, I had 1 year to go on my contract, but there were other players on the team that had contracts as well, and Richard had signed, I think he'd signed his team, the license back for $1 million. But, you know, if you're going to sign the license, if that's okay, if the league says, okay, we'll give you $1 million for it, the league didn't make sure that Richard owed people money who he owed money to. You know, there were other players like Greg Smith and Rupert Murdoch, Rupert Sapwell, and myself who were owed.
Would have been great if Rupert Murdoch was playing. You'd probably still have a team there.
But you know what I mean? And the NBL didn't step in and say, well, listen, Richard, for you to get that money, you need to pay these players. And for me, it was okay because it was a better deal with Townsville, so I was making more money. But, you know, the fact that you actually have to go through things like that is you're representing the league, and the league never really represented its players, I felt. You know, they always let the players down by not making sure that they got looked after and things like that. So, with Shane and Derek, and Mark Bragg had actually been my under 16 or under 18s basketball coach for Queensland. So I had good connection up there, and, it was good advice because it was, I thoroughly enjoyed playing up there in Townsville. It was a great place to play.
I think I remember Shane Hill saying that, you know, go to Townsville because Derek Rucker will make you a better player. What was it like playing with Derek Rucker?
Yeah, it was incredible playing with Derek. Derek and Clarence. And, you know, we had just a really good balance that year. Jason Cameron was there. He played a great role. Tony D'Ambrosius played a great role. Brad Davidson's first year in the league. We just had some other guys. Grant Kruger, everybody knew their role. Nobody tried to score more than they should or shoot more when they should. Just everybody had an understanding. And, you know, we were doing very well. I think we were second or third before Clarence Tyson blew his knee out. You know, and the balance we had was just very, very good. And, you know, Derek made it easier. Clarence made it easier. Everybody on that team made it very easy to play. Now, we weren't the most gifted, but everything just gelled really well because we all knew our roles. We didn't step outside of them. There were no egos. You know, that was good. And we just kind of knew. We just knew that if Derek was on a roll, then he was on a roll. If I was on a roll, and, you know, same with Clarence. It was just, and people got you the ball. You hit two or three shots in a row, that's, as a scorer, that's great. That's even better when the other four guys on the court say, hey, listen, he's hot, let's get him the ball. And they just worked that, you know, and I don't know, Derek was just a freak. You know, I saw him put up some incredible numbers, and he made my life very, very easy playing with him. I was quite fortunate.
It must have been a very good time there too at Townsville, just from the fact that, you know, the team had been in the league for a number of years, probably four or five by the time you got there. And, they had, you know, the whole time had a very, very strong, crowd and supporter base and that sort of thing. So for you guys to actually come along and gel, like you said, and actually put some wins on the board, no doubt, that furnace would have been rocking.
It really was. It was, you know what, the fans, I think they're the best fans in Australia for basketball because I still remember the second year I was up there, the 98 season, and I'd started I think it might have been the first eight games. I was only averaging 6 points. I just could not, my body felt incredible. I was in such good shape and my game felt good. I just couldn't put the ball in the basket. It would just rim in and out all the time. And then, you know, one of the things I always did was always wanted to give back to the fans because, you know, just to do a little bit extra. So in Townsville, only two players have to go out, or when I was there, two players would sign autographs after the game. But I always went out after every game, no matter what. And the last thing you wanted to do is when you're averaging points a game is face your home crowd. Because, you know, I was embarrassed. But I remember one game I was walking through the crowd and I was walking with my head down, and the Townsville people were just like, Simon, hang in there. We know you can do it. It was just, their encouragement was so good. It just made me feel so fantastic that I was like, man, thanks. You know, and there's not many crowds that are actually that understanding and that encouraging, you know, from a sporting standpoint. So, and they got behind us, and it did used to go crazy. You know, it used to rock, call it the furnace. That's funny. I forgot it was the Furnace, now it's the Swamp. So it was good to be part of the Suns and the Crocs, you know, I got to be part of both, so which was really good.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, we can't sell you short. You did average 18 points a game that season and dropped 39 against the Magic to finally get yourself back on track, so it wasn't all for nothing.
Mate, you got a very good memory. That was the game. You know what it was? I can't remember who it was. They had a little guy who used to play for them. Do you remember the little guard? What was his name?
Are you talking about South East Melbourne?
Yeah.
Clint McDaniel?
That's him.
Yeah.
He spat in my face. I'll never forget that. He spat in my face during the game, and that just... I think I had 7 or 8 threes that game. But it was so disgusting because his breath was so bad. That's what was so disgusting. I was like, oh, my God, I can't believe he just spat in my face.
Most people sort of like add a couple of 3-pointers on. You actually went 9 for 12.
9 for 12.
Yeah, spat in your face, huh? Well, there you go.
I'll never forget that.
There was no talk before. Just out of the blue, totally just sneak shot.
Oh, no, there was definitely a trash being spoken. Oh,
that's right. I just thought you were saying like just.
No. But no, it was like he was a great trash talker. He was a very good trash talker. But you know, it was all innocent. It was all above board. There was no mother slants. There was no sister slants. I was just tormenting him to death. You know, I was just defending and getting up in his face and making life miserable for him. And I was just fortunate enough that I couldn't miss. So it's always good when you're doing that.
I mean, Dennis Rodman made a lot of headlines back in the day for choosing to go naked rather than wear fur. And you decided to go the rather alternative route. I can't think of, you might have a better knowledge than me, I can't think of too many professional athletes in Australia that have posed nude for a gay magazine, but nonetheless, you did with a bow and arrow in tow.
Yeah.
tell us, what were you just sitting back in your lounge room, maybe like watching, I don't know, you must have been watching like a Ricky Martin film clip or something and thought, I'm going to pose nude in a gay magazine. How does that happen?
I was good mates with Ian Roberts, who played footy up there, and his boyfriend and my girlfriend were pretty tight, and he just released his book. Now Paul Freeman, who wrote his book for him, you know, I was just talking to Robo about his experience with Paul, and I said, oh, I wouldn't mind doing a photo shoot with Black and White magazine. And he said, well, listen, Paul's a really good writer. If you want to do it, I'll get him to write the article. I said, yeah, cool. So I was going to do Black and White, that magazine Black and White. But Blue's its parent, you know, its sister magazine. But with Black and White, it was going to be three months away, and that was going to be in the middle of our season. And Stacks said, listen, it's be too much of a distraction. You know, you have to go to Sydney for a whole day. You won't be able to get, and I was like, cool. And then they came back and they said, well, listen, how about Blue Magazine? We can do it next week. And I said, what's Blue Magazine? They said, listen, it's our sister magazine. It's a gay magazine. And I said, oh, yeah, that could be a little bit more controversial. That'll probably annoy the NBL a little bit more. Let's do it. And then, and that's how it came about. But, you know, the thing with it, the girl.
Did the NBL ever say anything about it or?
No, they didn't say anything. You know, they'll be fine. But the girl, Gabby, the photographer, really good photographer. And, you know, it's not a cheap, you know, dirty magazine. It's a pretty, as far as artistic talent goes, it's pretty artistic. So, you know, it was a good experience. It was 8-9 hours and it's pretty cold in that warehouse, let me tell you.
And for those of you that sort of listening and not sure what we're talking about, Simon's covered from head to toe in gold, which I'm sure wasn't too comfortable wearing all that gold paint either.
Mate, you know, it wasn't too bad. What it was from the body shop. It was mango moisturizer, and they put a gold powdery paint in it.
Oh, so you could. So it was your lunch as well.
Yeah. So it was quite funny because you had Gabby, who was the female photographer, and you had three gay guys who were doing all the stuff. Now one of them was, I think his name was Stu. I can't even remember, but he was the one putting the gold all over me. Now he got to the last bit. And he went to scoop it up and put some gold. I go, hey, Stu, I've got this last bit, man. It's all good. He goes, oh, Simon, I've been waiting to do that for the whole last 30 minutes. So I had to jump in and get there before he did. But it was a good experience. It was good fun. And, you know, she's
probably really upset that you forgot your name.
It was, how long ago was it? 1998. A while ago.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, you've sort of said that, you know, you haven't really given basketball much thought, haven't really, I mean, I'm sure you have a look from time to time, and no doubt you've been watching the Olympics and that, but you sort of moved on to the second part of your life. I know you've got a personal training you know, sort of company there, and you're doing well, as well as, I sort of laughed when I had to see the name, you've got Trailer Trash, a skip tip bin company. What else, you know, tell us about these endeavours you've got and what else are you doing in life after basketball?
Yeah, well, the personal training was good. You know, I've always been into health and fitness, so I kind of do that for fun, but so that's all good. And I've got a weight loss coaching business, which is totally separate from the personal training. So, and then I had some other investments in Melbourne that I don't have anymore, but while I was down there, I saw a skip bin company called Trailer Trash Mobile Skip Bins. Now, I love the name because it was trailer trash, and on the side of the 4.5 cubic meter bin that's specially designed on a double axle trailer, there's a picture of a silhouette of a woman. And so I kind of laughed out loud that when I saw that and liked the concept and thought, well, let's bring that to Queensland. And so I franchised that through Queensland with my brother. And then I've got a marketing and distribution company where we specialize in health and beauty products. And then there's a good mate of mine, Matty Rogers, who played rugby league and rugby union for Australia. You know, and we sit down with people and show them how to create, assets using their everyday expenses. So that keeps us pretty busy as well, which is good.
Yeah, well, obviously you're pretty busy with all that going on. And, I mean, you know, you sort of said that you haven't really paid too much sort of focus to the NBL since stepping out of the game and, you know, don't follow it quite so much, but do you think that there might be a chance down the track where, you know, we might see you back in the NBL as, you know, maybe someone's coaching staff? I know, obviously, Shane Heal's at the Sydney Kings now, so, you know, there's a bit of a connection.
I don't even know. Like, I spoke to Joey Wright about doing, being an assistant coach with him this year before Gold Coast went into administration. And we're just going through some things, and I didn't even know the players. Like, I knew Gibbo, I knew Wurtho, I knew Bubbles, but I knew Bubbles, Chris Goulding, but I'd never actually seen him play. And I knew him. So it was going to be a good learning curve for me to just catch up and see what was going on. Okay. Yeah, it's really weird. It was one of those things that I'd never ever thought about it until this year. And I think now it would have been really good being under Joey, because I just want to learn, you want to learn from the best people, and there's some really good coaches in the NBL. So I think, when I do get back into it, I just want to, be around somebody who I can just absorb all the knowledge from. When you're away for 8 years, it's, there's a fair bit that's changed, and there's a few different.
Shane's down at Sydney now. So, I mean, you scored 49 points down there in 97, so maybe you could be an assistant coach and work with our shooters. Maybe that could be.
Well, I think Sydney are going to be really good. You know, they're really fortunate to have somebody like Shane, coaching them. You know, you're talking about a guy that, outside David Anderson, David Anderson just had such an incredible career overseas, but Shane had a lot of people don't realize how successful and important Shane's career overseas was. And it's kind of a shame. I was very lucky to go over there and see how he was over there, and he was so highly regarded by all the European countries, the top European teams, that I don't think the Australians really, appreciated what he did overseas, because he's Red, who was one of the guys who played with Sam Mitchell in the Minnesota Timberwolves. Shane destroyed him in shooting competitions through the 8-month season of the NBA. And Sam Mitchell told Reggie Miller that Shane Heal is the greatest 3-point shooter on the planet. And Reggie Miller wasn't happy with that comment. I mean, that's how good Shane was,
when you brought that up, wasn't there betting involved on that too? Shane put money on it every time, and then he'd win, and then he'd say, oh, double or nothing next week or something.
Yeah,
like
yeah. And then it got to the point, I won't tell you how much it was, but then it got to the point where Shane just looked at him and said, listen, you are never going to beat me. You will never, ever beat me. Just stop. They did it one more time, and he said, I'm never going to beat you. Just don't let me. So the Kings are really fortunate because there's nobody that's had Shane's experience and played at the level that he's played at, whether it's NBA or Europe and Olympics. The things he's done is quite extraordinary. So all those guys who are playing underneath him will definitely become better players because they're going to learn a lot. They'll learn a lot more than him than they will from most other coaches.
We always finish off asking our guests You know, as a player coming through the ranks, sort of what sort of teams did you follow and what sort of players did you look up to as a kid?
Do you mean NBL teams or just NBA teams? Or?
Well, I guess you sort of grew up a bit early, like early compared to like NBL hadn't been around for too long by the time you were sort of, you were probably playing basketball before the NBL was around, but sort of what were some players that you sort of looked up to as a junior, like 17, 16, whatever it was, and what team did you go for back then?
Well, as a kid, young, 12, 11, 12, this would be way before most people. In 1980 and 1981, St Kilda Saints, who they won the first two championships and then should have won the third, but they went and played the World Championships. They had a left-handed shooter called Rocky Smith, and Rocky was unbelievable. I think he averaged 30 back then. I don't even think there was a three-point line back in those days. But
40-minute games too.
40-minute games, and you know, he was incredible. And I, you know, and he lived with us for a little while before they got him a place. And I remember taking him out into the street with the kids that we played street cricket. And the first time, someone bowled him a full toss, and he smacked it about 100 metres. It went for miles. Then the next delivery was a Yorker, and he started yelling at the guy. He said, "That's not right." So. But as far as playing goes, I loved watching Rocky in the NBL. He was somebody for me that I always loved. Believe it or not, it was funny. Steve Breeny, I used to love Steve Breeny when I was about 11 or 12 years old. They used to call him the garbage man. But you know, they were all guys that played for my dad's team. You know, because I was just a kid and I used to go and watch him play or practice every single day. But I remember, I can't remember what year it was, but I had this fascination with Eric Sleepy Floyd, who played for the Golden State Warriors. I think he dropped 50 in one game, and I just
jumped on him ever since.
Oh, I just loved him. I just thought it was, because he was so tiny and quick, and yeah, I think those guys. No one really out. I mean, Leroy was pretty awesome too when I was 14. You know, back in 1984, 85, 86, 87. For people who never got to see Leroy play, you know, if you saw him towards his end of career, it's kind of a shame. Like most athletes, but early on, he was incredible. You know, he was absolutely incredible.
I mean, even when he retired, though, he was averaging still double figures for Brisbane, and like, you know, he was still a pretty important part of their team. It just seemed like he could play forever.
Yeah, mate. You know what? He may have averaged double figures, but it wasn't a good double figures. His mindset was, I just want to get points, and that's. And it's hard not to think like that when you're on a team that's getting smashed every week, you know.
Especially when it's been your role for so many years too. You don't want to give up. Sort of, you know, you think it's your place.
Yeah, and yeah, and that's, you know, he was, but you know, before, you know, while he was in his prime, he was incredible. But defensively incredible too, because you could play the lanes, and even though he cheated a lot, you could get back, you know, because he was so quick and he was so long. But when you get older, when you overplay those lanes, you don't get back. Your man just goes in for a dunk.
Yeah, Andrew Gaze found that out last, I think.
Oh, mate, what are you talking about? Drew was like that even since he was 17. It didn't really matter. It wouldn't have really mattered for him. Yeah, but no, that, I mean, those are really the guys, mate. They were old school guys, you know, that I always... I mean, I spent some time with Kermit Washington, who had a pretty big impact on my life over in, before I went to college. I went and lived with Kermit for 2 months. And
really? That's really interesting. Like, obviously, you know, a lot of people wouldn't know about Kermit Washington. He's most commonly sort of looked in a bit of a negative way from that, the punch to Rudy Tomjanovich. Well, tell us about Kermit Washington.
Well, I went and lived with him for 2 months, and, you know, I saw an article he'd written in a magazine, and back then you didn't have computers, so I had to write a letter to the Los Angeles Lakers, and the Lakers gave me Pete Newell's address, and so then I sent a letter to Pete Newell, and then Pete Newell gave me Kermit's address, and I sent a letter to Kermit, just saying, listen, you said in this interview that I saw that you just want to train people who want to become better, and I want to become better. I got college, can I come and stay with you? And he said, yep, come and train with me for 2 months. And, you know, he was strength and conditioning coach of the Portland Trailblazers at that time. And so I got to, lift weights, run, and play one-on-one with, you know, guys like Jerome Kersey and Terry Porter and Steve Johnson, you know, every day and Kevin Duckworth for 2 months. You know, so imagine an 18-year-old and that's what you're seeing every day. So I was really fortunate. Kermit had a big impact because he was such a gentle man, quietly spoken guy. He just taught me how to work even harder than what I was, you know, just to do more than the other person. And that's all it instilled with me. You know, I wasn't the most talented or most gifted, but all I used to try to do is just work as hard as humanly possible. So at the end of the day, I could look back and say, well, could I have done anything more? Now, as far as working on my game, no, I couldn't have. Now, working on my attitude, definitely. You know, definitely working on my attitude and my mental philosophy could have definitely been changed a lot. But as far as the physical side, I can look back and say, you know what, I gave every team everything I could, and that's something I'm proud of. So.
Yeah, it's just, you know, amazing you sort of talking about Kermit Washington being just a gentleman, because obviously he's done so much for basketball. You know, I've read so many good things that he's out there working with people all off his own back a lot of the time, but, you know, it's a lot of, the only thing a lot of people remember of him is obviously, yeah, punching Rudy Tomjanovich, which was such a vicious punch. I think I remember somewhere reading so that Tomjanovich could taste the spinal fluid leak into his mouth or something like that. But yeah, obviously tarred by that incident, but a great man nonetheless.
Yeah, and you know, I asked him about it, and he was cool enough to talk about it, and he said, listen, you know, it's really unfortunate, but you, what do you do when there's an all-in brawl on the court and someone's running at you from the side and you just think you're going to get hit? You just react and then that's it, you know, and you just never know when you're in that situation. It was unfortunate and he wishes he could have taken it back, but you know, hindsight's it's a good thing, but unfortunately it's not the case.
Well, yeah, we'll wrap it up. Simon, it's been amazing that you've taken the time out to talk to us. Really appreciate it. Best of luck with that, with the trailer trash. and yeah, we hope that we can see you in the NBL again sometime soon.
No worries, mate. Thank you for the time. Take care.
Ladies and gentlemen, that was Simon Curl. Feel free to hit us back with any feedback or thoughts that you've got about the podcast on Facebook or Twitter. Keep checking out the website, aussiehoopla.com. And make sure that you subscribe to Aussie Hoopla on iTunes so you're the first to hear all the latest podcasts. Feel free to leave a comment there too, that'd be fantastic. And I mean, generally we like to leave you with a little story, but I mean, where do you go after Simon Curl, really? There's not a better storyteller in the Australian basketball community than Simon Curl. So the only kind of story I could think of when I thought of all the stuff to follow up with Simon Curl is maybe a quote from Stephen Marbury back in the day. When he reflected on his playing mentality, he said, "When in doubt, shoot. That's how I look at it." See you guys next time.